Good morning. Thank you, Bishop Shannon, and thank you, Diocese of Virginia. It's such a pleasure and honor to be here. It's my first time to Shrinemont, and this morning as I was waking up to birdsong, I thought, is that my alarm that's set to birdsong? No, it's real birds. So it's really great to be here. Thank you to Julie as well for her help, and to Buck Blanchard, who knew our work in the Office of Government Relations and helped connect us. I also want to say how much I've enjoyed the conversations I've had with you since I've arrived. Thank you for sharing some of your stories with me and some of the incredible work you've been doing. It's just been a real pleasure to get to know you, and I look forward to more conversations. If what I've heard is any indication of the kind of work and thoughtfulness that you are all taking part in, it's a really good and inspiring sign for me to know the kind of work that our church is doing in your parishes and congregations. I will speak about the work of our office and give an understanding of how we understand and approach advocacy, what it is that we do in Washington, D.C., and how we can be supportive of you. In the workshops, I do look forward to a conversation about how we can work together and how we can make sure that in the Office of Government Relations, the work that we're doing is supportive and we're sharing the right kind of resources for what you need. So, who are we? The Office of Government Relations was established in 1978. We were initially set up to, and this is from the Executive Council text here, to serve as a liaison between the entire Episcopal Church and the U.S. government, to aid more effective participation in Episcopal Church people in the government of the U.S. so as to maintain and strengthen our Republican form of government, and to make more effective the Christian witness in its conduct and processes. Our current mission statement, how we understand our work now, is up on the screen. So the wording is different, but not much has changed in the 40 years since we were established. We are here to serve as an office of public witness in Washington and to represent the policy positions of the church to the U.S. government and the broader policy community in Washington, D.C. We are a team of four full-time staff, and we have one staff person who is split with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I will speak more about our priorities later, but to give an overview of personnel, we have Jace Hafner covering domestic policy and climate, Lacey Brummel, who works on refugees and immigration policy, Alan Yarborough, who is our office manager and communications coordinator, and Patricia Casare, who is the ELCA shared position, who covers international issues. So in our conversations, I've heard a few of you who've connected with some of the folks on our team. So that's great to hear, and you know, they're real assets to our office, and I hope you can be in touch with them as well. It may be helpful to share some of my background with you. First, I am Episcopalian. I'm a member at Ascension and St. Agnes in Washington, D.C. I was raised in the Presbyterian, so don't hold it against me, but I came to the church when I was in divinity school, actually, and have been just thrilled to find this and make this my church home. I've been in this role coming up on 8 months. I've spent most of the past 15 years working in Washington, in and out of government, at think tanks, at the Defense Department, State Department, focused on post-conflict reconstruction, humanitarian assistance, and disaster response. I've focused a lot of my work on Islam and Christian-Muslim relations, especially in Africa, and have done a lot of work in places I know you have strong relationships with, so in Sudan and South Sudan, Tanzania. Most recently, I was working in the Office of Religion and Global Affairs in the State Department, which was a new office set up in 2013. And in that role, I was able to see the kind of impact that faith-based advocacy could have and what a tremendous gift it is to be able to have churches and faith-based institutions engaging the government. And it was from seeing that from the government side that made me so excited to take this work, because I thought, we can have an impact here as the Episcopal Church and as part of the Anglican Communion. We really can have a powerful and important voice. Great. Government relations can seem a little bit nebulous. So what does that really mean? On a basic level, it means that we are petitioning our government on behalf of the church, so a constitutionally guaranteed right. We meet with members of Congress and their staffs. We engage the administration and the White House, as well as civil servants, foreign service officers, career government personnel, who also are a big part of how the government functions and can be really influential on certain policy issues. How many of you, what is a guess of how many Episcopal members of Congress there are? How many do you think? 150, that's a lot. Wow, 150 Episcopal members of Congress. It's fewer than that. Yeah, there's 40 Episcopal members of Congress, which is about 7% of Congress, and I think the Episcopal Church is, what, about 1 to 2% of the U.S. population. So we are slightly overrepresented in Congress. Our Episcopal members of Congress, I think, reflect the political diversity in the church. There are 23 Republicans and 17 Democrats and one independent, thank you, Angus King from Maine. So we are engaging Episcopal members of Congress, and we do have a special affinity for them, but of course our work is much broader than that. Any guesses as to how many Episcopalians there are in the Virginia delegation? Anyone know names of? So you have four Episcopal members of Congress in the Virginia delegation. So Don Beyer, who's also a Williams grad like myself, so I have a double affinity with him. Whitman, Bobby Scott, and then Griffith are all Episcopalians. So as you're doing advocacy, I hope that you say, you as an Episcopalian may understand our church's position because you share our faith tradition. So as I said, we do engage Episcopalians, and we're doing work with those members in particular, but that's not the only way that we can engage. The Friends Committee on National Legislation doesn't have any Quaker members of Congress, and they're incredibly effective in their advocacy work because they have a grassroots network. The Episcopal Public Policy Network is our national grassroots advocacy network. This is how most people have heard of our office. So Office of Government Relations runs the Episcopal Public Policy Network. We send out email alerts weekly with requests to call or write your member of Congress, sometimes with requests to contact the administration, sometimes providing educational resources or tools. I urge all of you to sign up for this if you haven't already. This is a really great resource, and we put in a lot of effort to try to have this be usable by folks in the church and to help them do their work. We also use social media to promote our advocacy, to share articles, and to educate. Oops. Yikes. Okay. As Bishop Shannon mentioned, all of our work is grounded in the General Convention resolutions and also the resolutions of Executive Council. Any of us can look up what these resolutions are on the archive side of the Episcopal Church. That can be a little bit unwieldy because there's many resolutions over the years. Our office has put together a document, Policy for Action, that lays out the public policy-related positions of the church. So there's a section on the Middle East and on healthcare and on anti-poverty work and civil rights, those kinds of things. So it can be a really good tool to see where the church stands on various issues. I would also say that if there are things you disagree with or those in your congregations disagree with, that, of course, General Convention is a body that can put forward new resolutions and can change. So there is a democratic element to this. And so if there are those who feel like these resolutions don't reflect, and that can be changed. It's not set in stone. These do get updated. Advocacy involves efforts to educate, motivate, organize, and empower people to action for justice and peace through networks, partnerships, and sharing and creating resources. We aim to influence the decision-making process, to create awareness among policymakers, in the media, and in the public. And we work in coalitions to do this most effectively. I distinguish our work from those of lobbyists. So I don't love it when people say, oh, you're the DC lobbyists. The one reason for that is that we're not actually lobbyists. So we are technically part of the church. We're not a registered lobbying organization, which is a separate legal status. So we are the office of the church, and again, not a separate organization. The other piece is I tend to think of lobbyists, narrowly defined, as really advocating for the interests of those who they're representing. So the Association of Oil Pipelines is trying to make sure that there's legislation and a favorable policy environment for the companies that make oil pipelines. That's not what we do. We are not advocating to make sure that Episcopalians and the Episcopal Church get special treatment and that we are prioritized somehow, or even that we retain our tax-exempt status as a church. We are representing the values of the church. And so that's a distinction that's important. We are lifting up the poor, vulnerable, and marginalized, and sharing those perspectives and voices, not just what it is that Episcopalians want. There's a lot of ways that we approach our work. We send out action alerts through the Episcopal Public Policy Network, as I mentioned. We carry out advocacy campaigns, so a longer-term campaign where we seek to mobilize a lot more energy around a particular issue. You will be hearing about in the coming weeks a campaign for prayer, fasting, and advocacy called For Such a Time as This, that's looking at ensuring that the federal budget has sufficient funding for domestic anti-poverty programs and overseas foreign assistance. It will involve fasting on the 21st of each month through the 115th Congress, and prayers as well as advocacy. So we invite you to be involved in that, and if you're on the Episcopal Public Policy Network, you'll get more information about that in the coming week, actually. We hold trainings and workshops, webinars, phone calls, and we welcome ideas of what would be useful given the struggles that you're facing. Our office is charged with signing on to statements or letters for the church, making sure that it matches our General Convention policy. We aim to be strategic in how we do these sign-ons. So there's actually a fair number of letters that we could sign on to that match our policy, but we want to make sure that the work we're doing is bipartisan. And I'll say more about this, but it does not help us if we're seen as a partisan church. If issues that used to be bipartisan, like foreign assistance, which is still bipartisan right now, and refugee resettlement, which is closer to fracturing, if those become the province of one party rather than the other, I think we all lose, because the parties will switch in the coming 20 years. And so if issues that we care about, like poverty programs, are only one party's advocating for those, half the time there won't be funding there for it. And so we really try hard to make sure that, and there are still many bipartisan issues, that those issues and the letters and the statements that we are signing on and putting the name of the Episcopal Church on are not only in line with our policy, but careful and respectful and not politically divisive. It's really critical. I would love to be in touch with you. We get a lot of letters where it's not appropriate for an institutional sign-on, but there are organizations looking for clergy to add their voices. So if you can pick up, I left business cards up front, but be in touch with me, and we can then pass along some of these opportunities if you would like to lift up your voice on things that maybe the church isn't going to publicly sign on to, but you want to make sure that you can share that you're supportive. In our office, we work hard to build relationships with members of Congress and with their staffs. And the reason for that is legislation doesn't, we're trying to do advocacy not just when it is a up or down vote and there's a bill on the floor. We want to shape and influence the legislation that gets to the floor and shape and influence the wording in the particular bills that make it. This is an example of a legislative advocacy process where sometimes the advocacy community can put forward an idea to a member of Congress who will then become a champion. Or the congressperson may have an idea and reach out to the advocacy community and say, please help me to get support for this. It's critically important and I know it's something you care about. So there's a lot that happens before something gets to a vote and before a bill is even introduced. So I would say much of what we do is prior to bills being introduced. And we engage as our advocacy targets, legislators, coalition colleagues, the advocacy community, generally speaking, policy think tank types, and academics. So it's pretty broad. Wow. Okay, if we survive this windstorm here. We are not the lead for local or state level advocacy. You have more expertise in knowing the Virginia legislature than we do. We can provide resources and tips and general information, but we really look to you and state level organizations to be able to have an impact on the state and local level, where really so much happens that's critically, critically important. I'd also just highlight that, again, we are not advocating when we don't have policy. So there's a number of issues, for instance, nuclear power, fracking. There's some issues that we don't have policy on as a church, and so, of course, we won't take any kind of stand on them. Okay. This is maybe a question some of you are asking or some of you have asked before. It's an important one to address head on. Why do we need this office? We have as Christians, a scriptural basis for the work that we're doing. This is one verse, there's many, many more, of course, that we could point to. We also have a baptismal covenant that calls us to respect the dignity of every human being. We feel like it's a core part of our Christian identity to be doing this witness of public ministry and public policy advocacy. We're representing the values of the church in what is actually a very loud and very crowded marketplace where there are other voices and forces pushing for those that are opposite ours. It's not as if we step back that there will just be a neutral space and the best idea will emerge. There's a very full advocacy and lobbying space and we need to be in there. As Christians, to fulfill our baptismal covenant and also what we're called to do from Scripture. The other reason is that the federal government matters. We are often asked, why do we need advocacy? Our church does feed the hungry. We have a soup kitchen. Our church does help the needy and homeless. We have a homeless shelter we support. And that is tremendous and life-giving and critically important work. But right now, where we are in this country is that the federal government provides 95% of food assistance for people who are hungry in this country. And private organizations, so churches, charities, and nonprofits provide 5% of that. So if churches and charity organizations are ready to have 20 times more output in this coming year, then, you know, we don't have a stance sort of ideologically as to the role of the government. But right now, in the next fiscal year, this is where we are. And so we need to recognize that the importance, the critically important role the federal government plays. These programs are also effective. So the poverty rate would be 26% without federal assistance programs. It's between 13 and 14% because of housing assistance, food stamps, and other programs that really have an impact. Another reason why we do federal government advocacy is because a number of issues are handled exclusively by the federal government. To give one example, refugee resettlement is a federal issue. So you can't bring in refugees to the U.S. except through the public-private partnership where the U.N. designates someone a refugee, and then through the State Department and the Department of Health and Human Services, refugees are resettled. So that's not something churches can do on their own. You can support a family once they've been vetted and have arrived in the country. We can support the great missional work you do overseas and the work of Episcopal Relief and Development, but when it comes to issues like the weapon systems in South Korea, that's a federal government issue that we can lift up the voices of our Anglican Communion partners and share that perspective on, and for refugee resettlement too. Okay, this is a question some of you may have asked yourselves, or again, been asked. Can I do advocacy without being partisan or overtly political? Is it even worth it if it's so divisive and people are so upset about this? Why would we even try? And my answer to this is yes, we can. So in the 1950s, the Episcopal Church was known as the Republican Party at Prayer, and now there are those who make the claim that we are the Democratic Party at Prayer. That's not the case. As I said, our members of Congress, I think, probably reflect the demographics of the Episcopal Church writ large, which is fairly split. I think Virginia may well be a good example of that as well. You have a congressional delegation that's close to evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. To share again where I'm coming from, I worked in a Rumsfeld Pentagon and a John Kerry State Department, so I'm not entering this role with a particular partisan agenda, but rather from the policy side. What are the policies that we can make sure to advocate for that make the most sense and that coincide and align with the values we have as a church? I'm also the product of a bipartisan marriage. I have a Republican father and a Democratic mother, and they've been married 44 years. And you might think that there's some kind of truce of just don't talk about politics. That's not true. Amazingly, they have been married for 44 years and fight about it all the time. So what that has given me, and happily married too, but what that's given me is also a sense that people can have different perspectives and be good people and have come from a good place and just have different views about the role of government and particular policy issues. So in this moment, we have to resist the tendency and strong impulse to demonize one another and to think that if you're of this political party, you hate children, or you want people to die and be sick. I mean, no, that's not the case. So I think that we as a church are nonpartisan, but that doesn't mean that we have to be non-political. And I know you've had extensive conversations about this at your convention and otherwise, but how we talk about it is engaging from a place of values rather than issues. So talking about our shared values as a starting point and seeing if we can build common ground from there. As Episcopalians, we can tell stories and share the stories that you're hearing and that you're experiencing with members of Congress and also with one another to be able to help ourselves understand one another and really be in communion. We can also turn to evidence. That's something I also want to highlight. We are in a tradition where we're able to rely on reason and on evidence, and we can look for the best data and the best research to come up with the best policy solutions. So if we want to control gun violence, and I know your bishop has had a lot of leadership in that space, should we invest in gun buybacks? Well, actually the evidence is pretty clear that's not helpful. So maybe gun buybacks isn't the solution that we're advocating for from a policy perspective, but there may well be other measures that can help address gun violence and preventing and reducing it. We can share data. I think that's critically important also. So on refugee resettlement, there's been a lot of churn in the press about whether or not refugees can enter this country safely. Well, we can speak to the fact that there's an 18 to 24 months vetting process for refugees, and that is the most vigorous and stringent process for anyone to come into the country. and that there's the risk. I think Cato Institute put out a number that it was a risk, you know, one, a chance of 1 in 3.6 billion that you would be harmed by a refugee. We can help people to know that undocumented people in the U.S. do not commit crimes at a higher rate. There's evidence on that, and that's not true. That doesn't mean we're going to necessarily align on everything coming after that, but I think as clergy and as leaders, you can help to bring the data and information in to the space so that we're not acting out of fear, but instead out of information and also finding love to be able to act from there. I would also say that these conversations are hard, and they, I think, political conversations are in some ways holy conversations, and we need to practice sacred discernment about how we engage in advocacy, and then also, I think, in the creating of the resolutions that then guide our work as the Office of Government Relations. And if, as people of God, we're not able to have these conversations across political divisions, how can we expect Americans to? So I think as the church, we have an opportunity and a call to be leaders in this space. Our priorities as an office. We focus on addressing the most critical human need in all of its forms. So the way we frame these priorities are from the presiding bishop and, again, General Convention resolutions. So we look at the environment, refugees and immigration, and international development and conflict with a particular focus on the Anglican Communion. Throughout these, we look at the role, we look at racial justice, recognizing that environmental racism has an impact on how we think about climate and the environment, and that much of the discourse around refugees and immigration is racially inflected, and then again also on the international development and conflict piece as well. We advocate for clean water. We've been engaged in advocating around Flint, around Standing Rock, specifically for making sure that the water was protected for the people on the Standing Rock Reservation. We are leaders in the We Are the Arctic campaign. So the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge has a coastal plain, and on the edge of that are the Gwich'in people, 90% of whom are Episcopalian and who've asked us to take the lead in the Arctic advocacy. There's a bill now in the Senate on designating the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge a wilderness area, and neither of the two Virginia senators have signed on, in fact. So if you want to do advocacy on that, that would be welcome. International development and Anglican Communion. So half of Anglican Communion provinces are in conflict or post-conflict. That means that as we do the work, there's a piece of our advocacy that's focused on foreign assistance, and the new funding bill that just was will be passed this week does have close to $1 billion for food assistance for emergency relief in South Sudan, Yemen, Lake Chad Basin, and Somalia, which is tremendous to be able to continue to support humanitarian assistance at that level. We're again grateful for the work of Buck and his partnerships with our office and global partnerships at the Church Center. And one of the things we can do also in our office and our unique voice is to be able to say that we're part of the third largest Christian community globally. And we can have a priest from Burundi pass through town and meet with members of Congress or their staffs or people in the State Department or the U.S. Agency for International Development. And that can be so instructive in terms of what are the concerns, what are communities hearing, what can the U.S. Embassy do, and then also what can the church do to help be a leader for peace and to help be a powerful voice. So that's another dimension of our work where we can share and lift up Anglican provinces' priorities in a way that we're not saying this is the Episcopal Church's position, but we are saying here's what our brothers and sisters are saying, and you need to hear this, and it can be hard to find that line of communication otherwise.
There's the mouse.
The Episcopal Church policy on immigration is that we advocate for comprehensive immigration reform that prioritizes family unity and allows for a pathway to full citizenship. To do this, we meet regularly with members of Congress and their staffs. We are part of the Interfaith Immigration Coalition, which is close to 50 organizations who are leaders in this area doing coordinated advocacy work. We also advocate on special issues, so the special immigrant visa, which actually also in this funding bill was just passed. That was for Afghan interpreters, translators, and others who worked with U.S. military in Afghanistan. And there was a special visa program for those who were in danger to come to the U.S., and there was just now 2,500 visas allocated, which is tremendous. So we've also done these special, more niche type issues, and for temporary protected status. So right now we're advocating for temporary protected status for 46,000 Haitians who will lose that status at the end of May unless that's reauthorized. There are 11 million undocumented people, we estimate, in the U.S. right now, 7 million of whom are in mixed U.S. undocumented families. So it's a big challenge, and one that I know many of you are facing and is maybe the most pressing issue that you're dealing with now and figuring out how to support your parishioners and communities. At this moment, there's more unauthorized immigrants who are overstaying their visas than who are crossing a border. So if you've ever had issues getting visas for foreign visitors, that's actually a reason why. That's a growing segment, and the State Department, I think, will be increasingly conservative in authorizing visas and will authorize fewer and fewer, actually. So just to be aware of that. There are a diversity of views on how to address immigration in the church, in the country, of course. There's also a lot of flexibility within comprehensive immigration reform to come up with a system that is both just and humane and fair and in a way that still allows the U.S. to be a nation of laws in a way that many folks are saying, well, you know, if there's amnesty, how can we be a nation of laws? There's a lot of room to come up with a solution for this. So I would just say that we can do, if we advocate on comprehensive immigration reform, there's a possibility, maybe not this Congress, but maybe the next or the next, to really be able to transform the system that right now has people living in fear and has families getting separated. I would just say that it's a very tough issue. On the issue of sanctuary, so the Episcopal Church has policy on the new sanctuary movement from 2015. It actually does not address sheltering. So it speaks about assisting people who are undocumented and their families and providing resources for them. We had a call that I know a few of you were on about immigration with bishops and some diocesan staff last week. Sanctuary is a very, in terms of sheltering, sanctuary is a very serious decision that you would need to consult with legal, with lawyers and get legal advice about. There are other ways to engage in sanctuary. As I said, our General Convention policy speaks about providing Know Your Rights training, accompanying. We're seeing a lot of anecdotal evidence that accompanying is helpful. And when people go to check-ins or court hearings, that can be positive for the folks who are needing to be accompanied. Sanctuary is also complicated at this moment, and I'll say that within the undocumented community, we're hearing some pushback on the term. So the idea that there's this welcoming church providing sanctuary and then the poor undocumented people coming in and receiving the charity. That's how some people are reading it, and they're not liking that language. And so I would urge, however you think about this and however you go through this process of discernment, to make sure that people who are undocumented and immigrants are in the lead. Those are the folks who need to make sure that their perspectives and their voices are being lifted up, and it's not just a kind of idea that you're coming to without the context of it. Happy to talk more about that. Again, it's a really complicated issue right now, and I think one that where the church can be a really powerful leader in many, many different ways, But depending on the circumstance and depending on the community and depending on what you find you need and where you are equipped to really have a positive impact. Episcopal Migration Ministries was set up in 1938, actually, or the work of Episcopal Migration Ministries began in 1938. They're also part of the church, so the same entity. To be clear on the terminology, a refugee is someone who has been designated by the UN, who's fled their country fearing violence and persecution, and then who the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has designated as a refugee. And then refugees who are in a who have fled are then resettled to a third country. Less than 1% of refugees are ever resettled to a third country. Refugees are different from asylum seekers, which are different from immigrants. So just to be clear on that, people who flee violence and come to the US or another country and then seek asylum have a different status. So they've come and they're petitioning to be able to stay legally because of fear and threats of violence. Refugees have an 18 to 24 months process overseas where they are vetted prior to arriving in the US. And then once they're arriving in the US, groups like Episcopal Migration Ministries and others partner to be able to resettle and house them in communities. Episcopal Migration Ministries website, great question, thank you. So because of the various executive orders around refugee resettlement, the president determines the number of refugees that the U.S. accepts every year. So Congress provides the funding for refugees to be resettled, but the president can determine the number of refugees. So the number was set at 50,000, but because that executive order is in the court system, the number which was set last year at 110, that's where we are. We will probably only settle 50,000 refugees this year because of the stop and start of the process. What that means for Episcopal Migration Ministries is that they are in a tough situation in terms of the being able to support themselves and sustain themselves financially and continue to do the ministry that they are called to do as a church. They have launched a fundraising campaign, Stand to Support Refugees. We work with them very, very closely on advocacy. And I would urge you to be involved in your community, either with an Episcopal Migration Ministry affiliate site or one of the other 9 refugee resettlement agencies, because EMM is not in Virginia. So the Lutherans are here and Catholic services and other groups where you can still, as a congregation, work with those groups and partner. We have policy on a whole range of issues. This is a list of some of the things that we get involved in and have policy on. There's General Convention policy on bottled water, actually, too. So if you ever see bottled water around, we're not supposed to be using it. And then, of course, on cluster bombs and net neutrality and 1984 policy on not moving the U.S. Embassy from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. So there's so many different issues that we can be involved in. The 3 priority areas are mentioned is where we're trying to take the lead and have a really powerful voice and impact. We are also responding to these issues as they emerge. Okay, advocacy tips for you. How many folks have called their member of Congress, met with their member of Congress? Okay, great. All right, bravo to all of you advocates. Actually, all of us who work in the Office of Government Relations live in the District of Columbia. So we have 1 Episcopalian non-voting member. So luckily we get to do other advocacy as well because we don't have anyone who can vote one way or the other. You can have a powerful voice in advocacy. A few things. Call, write, email, tweet. I mean, there's members of Congress are now all over social media. It makes a difference. There's some conventional wisdom that you've got to call and then emailing doesn't make a difference. Every congressional office is different. So there's not one set of rules that everyone follows of every day the boss gets three top issues that people called about. There's a whole different range of ways that people operate, so feel free to do what's best and easiest for you. Letters, if you mail them, are actually scanned and emailed because of security concerns. So you can, it'll take a little bit longer to get there. So call often. You can call every single day about the issue. You don't have to just call once and think it's done. I mean, you can put your member on speed dial and just call that office every morning on your commute and say, here's the issue I'm concerned about today. You don't have to be excited and about every issue that the Episcopal Public Policy Network is putting out an alert on. Again, we know that there's a range of opinions within the church, within our office, and there's a lot of policy. So people can engage as they feel called to. We all have different passions, we all have different interests, we all see how we can bring about a more just world in different ways. So we are giving suggestions and hope that you will take the advocacy steps we recommend, but also, again, I would say get involved in groups you really feel an allegiance to and be really engaged that way. Say that you're an Episcopalian when you call, if you feel comfortable with that. We think that's important, especially as clergy members. You are leaders in your communities, and that voice can have a different weight than a constituent calling, although constituents calling is also really helpful. You can share personal stories from your diocese. I was hearing about food pantries being down by 40%. That kind of story can make such a difference to a member of Congress who's looking to be able to respond to their constituents. And there's a lot of pressure to vote the party line, and there's a lot of pressure to vote in certain ways. So the more that you can put forward stories and share the perspective, I think we've seen that on healthcare in unprecedented ways in terms of constituents saying, no, we can't take this away. And just the vote yesterday that someone wasn't even on the radar as possibly not voting yes on the new healthcare bill said, I can't not let people who have pre-existing conditions in my district, I can't have them lose their coverage. So that can really, again, make a big difference. Amicus briefs, that's another way to get engaged, interestingly, if you would ever, as a church, be involved in that. Again, you don't have to make a legal argument in that, but that to be able to tell a story or share the perspective of your church and our denomination, that does matter, to be able to be engaged in the judicial process as well. Op-eds, again, from clergy are especially powerful. Open letters, statements that you sign onto that can then get press. Go to town halls, invite your members to come to your congregation and give a talk. There's so much you can do, so I'm happy to talk more about that in the workshop sessions. The website of our office is there, advocacy.episcopalchurch.org. We're on social media, so please follow us there too. And again, my cards are up there, and my email is on the screen, so please be in touch. And I really look forward to our conversations. And I think we have a few minutes for questions now with the bigger group, if that works. Thank you.